Podcast. My name is Ben Stone. Today is Thursday, August 9th, 2012, and this is podcast number 184. And if you haven't heard them yet, get over to badquaker.com and download my two interviews with Bill Buepert. They were for Tuesday and Wednesday of this week. So they're the two just preceding this one there, actually. Anyway, get over there and download those and listen to them because I think they're really good stuff. I really enjoyed talking to Bill, and he had some really good thoughts. Now, before we get going into today's podcast, I want to give my little commercial that I've been giving for the events that are going on in Washington, D.C., coming up on the 18th of this month. So I'm going to first read the little commercial thing here, and then I want to talk about it a little bit. Join the Raw Milk Freedom Riders and Lemonade Freedom Day for a picnic in celebration of our freedom of voluntary exchange for the foods of our choice. This is happening Saturday, August 18th, 2012 at noon. It's 3rd Street Southwest between Maryland and Jefferson near the Capitol Reflecting Pool in Washington, D.C. Now, here's the thing. If you can get down there, if you can get down to Washington, D.C. and get down to the Reflecting Pool and become a part of this, all you need really is just some food to share, and preferably if you have a camera or a second person with you or other people with you who have cameras, then you can just get down there, and it's the whole purpose is not to, you know, not to have a problem, not to cause a fuss of any kind, but just to celebrate the freedom to voluntarily exchange food and goods with one another as free people can in free voluntary fashion. Now, if somebody wants to make a fuss about that, if some costumed individuals want to come in and try to do something about it, that's why we need cameras, and we need to make sure that everyone there is being peaceful and remaining in the spirit of voluntary exchange. And if people in costumes, would they want to get rough about it, then we want to make sure that everybody understands that none of us are initiating this violence. That if violence is initiated in any way, it's going to be on the part of the costumed individuals, not on the part of the voluntary, peaceful, free people that are going to be there exchanging food. Now, in such a situation where costumed individuals decide that they do want to use violence, we don't want to resist. We want to photograph. We want to be as peaceful as possible, and we want to keep cameras rolling. And now this is the fun part. If you're at home and you can't make it to Washington, D.C., you can't make it down to the Reflecting Pool, you can't make it to be a part of this, there's still a way you can be a part of this. Here's all you have to do. Now there's several websites that are going to be streaming the live feed from the action there at the voluntary exchange and at the celebration. So I'm going to, the Friday before this is going to happen on a Saturday. The Friday before this is going to happen, I'm going to put links on badquaker.com, and the Saturday that it actually does happen, there will be links available on badquaker.com. And you can also get over, I'll give addresses and I'll put links to other sites in case something goes wrong with mine. We're going to have several different sites that are doing this. And I'm going to try... I say my site. It's not really my site. Anybody that knows how the badquaker.com structure is knows that it's not actually my site. But anyway, that's all beside the point. We're gonna try to have a live streaming feed at badquaker.com, and there's several other places, including Lemonade Freedom and a couple other websites, that are going to try to have a live streaming feed. And what you can do, if you can't make it down there and be a part of the action, you can still be a part of the action. Watch it on your computer from the comfort of your home or your office or wherever you happen to be on that Saturday the 18th. Watch what's going on the live feed. And if, now here's the important part, and this is how you can actually be an important part of this thing. If, for some reason, the D.C. Capitol Police come in and start arresting people, again, there's not going to be resistance, nobody's going to try to make a fuss, but if the Capitol Police decide to come in and arrest people, we're going to have, if we have enough people watching this on streaming feed, phone numbers are going to be available, and you can call the D.C. Capitol Police and tell them you're watching this, you're watching peaceful people doing no harm to anyone being arrested. And we can literally put waves of phone calls into the D.C. Police, and you can have an impact on this. Now, I want to talk about this a little bit because this is kind of radical, and there's been some... there's been sometimes this doesn't work good, and there's sometimes it works great. And I want to talk about just two different types of situations. Not long ago, there was a very controversial, within the Liberty Movement, a very controversial arrest made in Texas of a young lady that ended up with some hard feelings among a lot of Liberty people over this. And when she was arrested, she was stopped at one of these Nazi-like highway stops where they pull everybody over and give everybody a hard time. And so she was arrested in that. She was on her way to Porkfest up in New Hampshire. And so they drug her out of there and hauled her down and threw her in her cage. And there was a wave of calls that came in support of her. And this caused a really negative reaction among the people that had arrested her. And it may have caused her to be treated worse than she would have otherwise. Now, that's speculation because nobody knows, you know, how can you tell how exactly she would have been treated? Maybe, theoretically, she might have been treated better by having the phone calls. But either way, there's a big difference in that and a situation like what my friend Eddie Free, by the way, is one of the organizers of this event in Washington, D.C. on the 18th. But Eddie Free organized an earlier event in D.C. That you may know about, where there was dancing at the Jefferson Memorial. And when the people were arrested at that time, they had a live streaming going on. There were live filmers. Is that the right word? There were people there filming it live when it happened. They jumped on their computers. They got the word out, and there was a call flood into the D.C. police. And like Eddie was telling me, the police treated them very nice, very nice. Once they got away from the Jefferson Memorial, they were rough with them at Jefferson Memorial. But when they got them away from Jefferson Memorial, the police treated them really nice because the police knew that literally the world was watching. Now, this is very much in contrast to what happened with the lady in that got arrested in Texas that I was talking about a moment ago. They treated her pretty rough. But the difference is, see, she didn't expect to be arrested, and the police down there did not expect to have attention drawn to their activities. In addition to that, well, I hate to say it, but the event that took place in Texas was drug-related. Now, there's a whole different, it's a whole different world of reaction from individual cops, individual police, when they know they've got somebody on something, you know, they're fighting that drug war and they've got somebody. Well, they feel really justified in doing whatever it is that they do under those circumstances. But it's totally different when you've got protesters that are completely peaceful, that are not harming anyone, that are not part of the horrible war on drugs. They're just there, they're drinking lemonade, they're dancing, they're talking, they're completely peaceful and they're not harming anyone, and the cops show up and start manhandling them. Now you've got a whole different world of reaction there. The cops know. Those cops, deep down in their minds, they know what they're doing is evil. Now the cops out there on the, you know, that think that they're saving the world from the drug war, those cops are delusional, but they believe what they're doing is right. But nobody's dumb enough to believe that people need to be manhandled over lemonade. I mean, think about it. How twisted is your mind to think that you need to rough somebody up over lemonade? So if the police show up on the 18th and they start making a fuss about it, and we have that on camera, and thousands of people or hundreds of thousands of people start calling into the DC police saying, "We're watching. We've got our eye on you. We're looking right at you. We want to know what you're doing, and we want to know why you're doing it." I can promise you, and I try not to speak in absolutes, but here's a prediction of the future that I can practically guarantee. The DC police will react way different than those Texas cops, because the DC police are far more politically connected than those cops in Texas. So if the DC cops start getting rough on the Lemon Freedom Day and the Raw Milk Freedom Riders, if the DC cops start getting rough with those people, you can bet that a call flood will have a positive reaction, because they know all of their jobs exist because of politics. Not because in Texas, not because of layers of bureaucrats all patting each other on the back for every drug arrest. It's not like that. These people in the DC Capitol, these cops in the DC Capitol, they know that the eyes of the world are on them, and they know there will be repercussions, politically speaking, if they make themselves, you know, if they're too rough. So literally, you can be at home watching this on your computer, and if the cops decide to get rough, you can be a part of the action. I'll have on Saturday, it's our plan to have on badquaker.com the live streaming feed coming from the reflecting pool there, and we'll have all the contact information for the watch commander's office of the U.S. Capitol Police. And if something goes wrong, then it's going to be up to every one of the people watching to jump on the phone and start flooding that office with calls to say, "We want justice. We do not want these people harassed. We do not want them harmed. We do not want them thrown in prison for drinking lemonade and raw milk." Okay, so now I've talked about that, you know, what, 10, 15 minutes now that I've been talking about this? And the reason why, I'm not going to do the whole podcast on this, but the reason why I committed so much time to this in the beginning is because this is critical. This is the kind of a protest where if the goons in government want to be mean about it and want to be tough, then we expose the state for the myth and anger and violence that it really is. But on the other hand, oh, and then people see, people who look at the police and say, "Well, they're protecting us," and this is a way to show that no, in fact, they're not protecting you from anything. They are just there to enforce the will of the state upon people. And if the police play it smart and do not interfere, then it's one more little victory against the state and against the myths of the state, and it's bringing attention to how important it is to be able to drink raw milk if you want to drink raw milk, or sell lemonade for little kids to be able to sell lemonade on their front lawn if they want to sell lemonade. That's why I'm putting so much emphasis on this, because it's that important. And there's really no downside to this. I mean, you know, I've talked before how unprofitable it is to be martyred for a cause. And I've talked before about how if you get thrown in prison for 10 years on some stupid charge, you're stuck in prison and you do nobody any good. But honestly, if they arrest people for this lemonade day and this raw milk issue, the eyes of the nation are going to be on that, and people are going to see. It's going to make a big difference. So again, you know, if you can't make it to D.C., if you can't have a stand in front of your house, that's the other thing you can do. And we're kind of, I talk to the little kids across the street who have a lemonade stand now and then, and I told them, you know, August 18th, that's Lemonade Freedom Day. And they were all excited about it. They want to have their lemonade stand out on the 18th. So that's what we've got going on here. But for anybody who can't have a lemonade stand in front of your house, or it's not practical or whatever, you can't get down to your local city park or whatever and have a stand down there, that's fine. If you can't do that, that's fine. But if you're available to look at a computer and get on a telephone on Saturday the 18th, you can be a part of this. Okay, so That's my sales pitch. I'll drop that for the rest of the podcast. What I wanted to talk to you about, let me back up. A little bit more commercial here, and then I'll get into the main body of the podcast. But this is not really commercial. This is kind of an update on what's going on at badquaker.com. We've had a lot of requests for reading lists and for book lists and for, Ben, where did you find out about these things that you're talking about, George Washington and stuff like this? And early on, when we were first formulating Bad Quaker and putting the website together and everything, I kind of made the statement back then, I'm not gonna play this game where I have to put references and what page and what book and everything that I get everything I'm talking about. Because, a little bit of background, I've spent a lot of time online in other people's forums and in other scenarios like that on the internet. And I make a statement and somebody says, well, back that up with facts. And then I do 45 minutes of getting together page references and what book it came from and all the footnotes and everything so that I can back it all up. And I put it all together in a paragraph with all the references and everything. And I post that on a board. And, the troll's response is, nuh-uh, that ain't right. And it's just like, I put all that effort into that, and you're not even looking it up. You're not even going and reading those books. Why ask me for the references if you're not going to read it? And so that was my attitude when we first put together badquaker.com, was that I'm not going to spend hours and hours justifying every word I say. If you can't believe me, I spend my life trying to embrace truth and reject lies. And if you can't believe me, then go someplace else. I mean, that was my attitude. And that's a little rough, I know, but that's not what I'm seeing from readers and listeners of badquaker.com. I'm seeing an honest inquiry like, Ben, where can I read stuff like this? Where can I find out this? And it's not the confrontational stuff like I was facing on, in Facebook and in forums and places like that where trolls are just wanting to fight with you. It's not like that. The people I've found, listeners from badquaker.com and people who visit badquaker.com and comment and things, they're not, they're nice people. I'm really kind of amazed at the vast majority of really positive emails that I've gotten and positive inquiries and people saying, hey, maybe you can put together a reading list or something. And so we've talked about this here. And I think we figured out a way to do this and really help the listeners. What we're in the process of doing is we're probably going to have a whole separate page on badquaker.com. And I've got a lot of the lists put together already. I've been working on it. And I'm going to have, I don't know what it's going to be called. It might be called like Ben's Suggested Books to Own, or it might be something like Ben's Book List, or it might be like Ben's Reading List or something like that. But I'm going to have topics and then subtopics like we might have like history and then U.S. history and then the Constitution as subtopics. And then books that you can read that are specifically on that topic. And I'm going to have them classified in different ways. Like this is a book I have, I refer to all the time. I Conceived in Liberty from Murray Rothbard. I look at that constantly when I want to know things. It's more of a reference book than a reading book. So I'll make notes as to what kind of a book that it is and what it's good for looking at and so forth. And I'll put that all, hopefully we can get this done because it's a little bit more than I have the time to do by myself. But hopefully we can get that all up as a page and you'll be able to just go right to it. And then in podcasts, I can say, I can just refer to whichever book that I'm talking or that I'm basically referring to. And it'll be right there on the website. You can go right to it and look at it. And that brings me, well, no, it doesn't either. I've run out of time for this segment, so I'm going to break for a commercial, and as soon as I get back, I'll go into today's topic, and I'll stop rambling on like this forever about everything else that's going on. So I'll be right back. Stick with me.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network. A collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
Okay, let's get back into the podcast here. Now, sort of as an introductory to this, you know, what I was talking about with having the notations as to which books and everything like that, I want to let you know what sources I've used for today's podcast. Basically, the main sources that I've used is the book I mentioned a moment ago from Murray Rothbard called Conceived in Liberty. Now, there's a four-volume version of this, and then there the Mises Institute has put out a single volume, all four books all crammed into one, and I haven't actually seen physically touch this thing yet. I'm imagining, because there's so much in the whole four-book volume, there's so much in there, I can't imagine them cramming that into one volume without making tiny little print. But I'll have to get my hands on a copy of it and let you know what I think about that. But Conceived in Liberty by Murray Rothbard is a great history book that anybody who's really, really interested in the history of North America, really of the English parts of North America, the English-speaking parts of North America, really needs to get their hands on Conceived in Liberty by Murray Rothbard. The next book that I'm using in this podcast is a book called The Gangs of New York, An Informal History of the Underworld by Herbert Asbury. And this was printed in 1928, and you might know it because it's the book that the movie The Gangs of New York was based on. And that was a really cool movie, but the movie was just like one snapshot of the book. The book is not like a novel. It's more like a history, and it's written that way. It's not like the Hollywood thing. Although the Hollywood movie was cool, but that's, you know, okay. And then my other source for this is Wikipedia. As I was doing the research for this, I probably had about, I don't know, 7 or 8 Wikipedia pages open at the same time, and I was bouncing between them, and I was bouncing off the references in Wikipedia. And that's kind of how I do a lot of the times when I'm doing research. I'll have 5 or 6 Wikipedia pages open, and I'll be bouncing off of the references. At the bottom of the Wikipedia page, there's references down there, and I'll be bouncing off those and then trying to find text versions of those books to see what where the references are coming from and who's saying them and so forth like that. Now, the other thing I wanted to mention on how I do the research on one of these podcasts is it's kind of something that Bob Buford mentioned in one of the interviews I did with him. It's reading about history and reading what's given to us, what we have, but then not necessarily taking word for word exactly everything that you read about history, not accepting it word for word like it is, but realizing that the people who wrote history probably did so with an agenda, and so you have to look past that and try to bounce one author off the other or one historian off the other and try to get a bigger picture as to what they were really saying to you. And my example of how to do that is, I always fall back on this one because it's really easy for me, is Steinbeck. You know, Steinbeck wrote The Grapes of Wrath, which I read when I was a teenager, and I recognized right away, he starts talking in there about how using the terminology of Steinbeck's book, the Okies, the people from Oklahoma that were migrating to California, he said that they had an odd custom that they chewed their food with their front teeth rather than their back teeth. And, when I read that as a teenager, I thought, Steinbeck's an idiot. They chewed their food with their front teeth because they didn't have back teeth. These were poor people, poor farmers. You know, to be derogatory, you could call them dirt farmers living in Oklahoma and had been for generations. And their primary food was stone ground wheat and stone ground corn. Now, if you have your primary intake of food is stone ground wheat and stone ground corn, by the time you're about 45 or so, you don't have molars because the quantity of rock and the coarseness of specifically of the corn it grinds off the enamel off of your grinding teeth, off of your molars. And so they would have horrible teeth problems in Oklahoma and in Arkansas and places like that back in the 20s and 30s. It would have been really common to not have back teeth because of, you know, having this kind of a diet of stone ground wheat and stone ground corn. So literally, they were chewing their food with their front teeth because they didn't have back teeth. And if Steinbeck had half a brain, and if he would have just checked it out, maybe asked a question, he would have recognized that. And I realized that when I was a teenager, and I began to look at history in a different way, even starting with that. Steinbeck had an agenda, and his agenda was communism. And everything he wrote had that tilt to it. So in the future, people are going to read Steinbeck's stuff, and they're going to take it as history. But it's not history. It's propaganda. But you can get history out of it if you look past what he's saying and get to what he was looking at. So that's using Steinbeck and molars as an example. Now, for me personally, I've been asked how I've come to the conclusions that I have about George Washington. Well, one of the things that I've done with George Washington is you can find these online. They're in several locations, but the Library of Congress has all the personal letters of George Washington. And sometimes when I've been bored and didn't have, you know, this is a crazy kind of a thing I do, I've sat down and read letter after letter after letter of George Washington's and tried to put together in my mind what kind of a guy this really is and what kind of communications that he's using and how he changes his personality according to who he's writing to. His, you know, when he wrote to Jefferson, he spoke one way, and when he wrote to like Madison or Hamilton, he wrote in a very different way. And so, you know, you get the feel of what's going on, and you can make judgment. And that's the heart and soul of revisionist history. There, you know, revisionist history. I'm going to put a link to Wikipedia's definition of historical revisionism, and if you're wondering about that, hit that link and go over and read Wiki's definition of it. But revisionism has taken a bad rap because some people, especially statists, hate the idea that somebody might go back and look at the facts of history and come to a different conclusion. Also, there have been people on the left who have gone back and just made up history, you know, loosely based on facts, and then twisted it for, you know, socialist reasons or whatever. Anyway, so that's my method. Now I've almost run out this part of my break, and I haven't even got to my topic. So I may have to break my real topic into two sections. I probably will have to do that. So what is my real topic? The connection between crime gangs and police forces. My friend Eddie Free, I was talking to Eddie last night on the phone, and we were talking about the history of milk and how in the U.S., the gangs and the police worked together, and then eventually the government came in and really messed up the market in milk. And so I was talking to Eddie about the connection between crime gangs and police forces during the 1800s. Now, if you start to research the origin of police in the U.S., what you're going to find is prepackaged state myths, just the same repetitious myths thrown at you over and over. So it's really difficult to get past that. And if you start to research the origins of gangs in the U.S., they typically the narrative has a tendency to begin after the fact. Like they'll start talking about gangs in the 1930s, or they'll start talking about gangs in the 1950s. Well, you're a couple hundred years behind the curve. If you're starting to talk about gangs, let's say New York, you're starting to talk about gangs in New York in the 1920s. You're a couple hundred years behind the curve there. You need to back up to get the real history. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to back this story up, and we're going to move backwards in time to the 1600s. Between the 1600s and the 1700s in the North American colonies, and you have to remember that these were English colonies, primarily from, let's say Nova Scotia, modern-day Nova Scotia to modern-day Georgia. Pretty much everybody that lived along the coast from Nova Scotia to Georgia. Those were all English English people. They were, you know, that's the colonies, and the and that was all settled by English people, and the culture was English. Now there are exceptions. That, you know, New York was settled by the Dutch, and eventually the English took it over, purchased it, or whatever. But mostly speaking, from Nova Scotia to Georgia, it was English, and the English. And the thing to remember about the colonies is there was a high level of English bigotry against the Irish in the 1600s. The Irish had been stateless going back into antiquity. And in the 1600s, Cromwell invaded Ireland and destroyed the voluntary government that had been in Ireland and set up a forced, you know, a forced aggressive government under the English. And he didn't, as powerful as Cromwell's army was, Cromwell was not able to just march in and take over Ireland. The Irish would have just shredded his army. And he knew this. Cromwell was an evil man, but he was not an idiot. So how did Cromwell defeat Ireland? Well, it's very simple. He used the same tactic that Cortez used to defeat the Aztecs. And I don't think Cromwell even knew this, but that's what he did. And it's a time-tested method. If you're, you know, if you have a small, you have a small force and you want to attack a large force, all you have to do is get key locals involved, and the locals become your army for you. And that's what Cortez did. As Cortez moved across Central America towards the Aztec Empire, he gathered forces from the native people that the Aztecs were oppressing, mostly the Mayans and others like that, that had been oppressed by the Aztecs. Cortez gathered strength through them so that, you know, I think, I can't remember now if Cortez had like, 20, 40, 60 men, something like that, 100 men, whatever it was. It was a tiny little force, and he conquered the Aztecs with this tiny little force. And mostly that's what history remembers, but they don't remember that there were thousands of Mayans helping. So it wasn't just Cortez, you know, magically because he's on a horse and he has armor. That's the story told. But that's not the real story. Really, Cortez had a massive army. They just weren't Spanish. And then when he wrote home and told about it, of course, he didn't give the credit to the native Mayans and so forth. He took the credit himself. Well, that's exactly what Cromwell did when he went into Ireland. Cromwell bribed second-tier and third-tier Irish leaders and promised them grants of land that would be taken from higher-tier leaders and basically using bribes and some intimidation, Cromwell won the war in Ireland through not just through the savagery of his military, but also through the betrayal of Irish leaders. And so Ireland fell to the English in the 1600s. And there was this real hatred towards the Irish and the in England. And the English really looked at the Irish as savages. They didn't really look at them as civilized people. So after Cromwell conquered the conquered Ireland, we also have another thing that was going on in that same time frame. There was a problem of Protestant Scottish that had been kicked out of most of Scotland and were living in the wilds between in the hill country between Scotland and England, and they were forced to live off the land. They were forced to live in hiding. They would the clan governments because they couldn't be a part of English society. They couldn't be a part of Scotland's society anymore. Many of them were able to go into smaller towns and get small jobs here and there, but there was a lot of oppression against these people, and so a lot of them lived out in the wild, and the English saw them as a problem. And so one of the solutions to these problems of these Scots that were living on the English-Scottish border, these Presbyterians and Protestant Scottish, one of the possible solutions was to round them up and ship them to Northern Ireland. And so they were packed away, and they were shipped over into Ulster, and they became then known as the Ulster Scots. Now, again, in the 1600s, the Ulster Scots were a problem because they, you know, they were hard to control. And so a lot of these Ulster Scots were shipped to the New World, to the colonies. And they were shipped there they weren't called slaves. They were basically virtual slaves, but they were called indentured servants. And many times in northern England and southern Scotland, these ship captains would have a crew that would just go out and snatch up the children of these displaced Scottish. And so they, you know, I'm saying children anywhere from 10, 12, 14 years old, all the way up to like 18 or so, they would just snatch them up, forcibly, with the guise of law. This was done under, with the blessing of the crown. And they would haul these off to the New World. And the ship captain then would make a profit off of them, selling them as indentured servants. And the farmers or plantation owners or different businessmen of different kinds in the colonies would then buy these indentured servants, these Scotch Irish or these Ulster Scots, and here's the difference between an indentured servant and a slave. A slave was owned by the master. Well, so was the indentured servant. The indentured servant would work for a set number of years according to how much the master had paid for the servant. So it might be 8 years, might be 10 years, might be 12 years. And at the end of that, theoretically, the indentured servant would be free. But the problem was, if this indentured servant did anything wrong, they could be charged with a crime, and then the master could buy them out of jail and own them again. So, and of course the master could beat them. That was okay. He could flog them, whatever he needed to do that was perfectly acceptable. So it was just like a slave, just like that. He did have to feed them and keep them alive because they were an asset. But if they got close to the time when they were supposed to be released, all they had to do was get caught doing something that was a crime. So like if you were in New England, and you were an indentured servant, let's say you got caught praying incorrectly by one of your Puritan masters. And by praying incorrectly, for a Puritan, the way their rules and their laws were, pretty much anything that they decided was against the law was against the law. So for almost anything, praying wrong, maybe you crossed yourself, or maybe you didn't fold your hands correctly, or maybe you didn't look up correctly, or whatever. That's good enough. You didn't pray correctly. They give you a few whacks, throw you in jail, and then your master would buy you back out, and you're indentured for another 8 years. See? So really, technically, there was no difference between the slave and the indentured servant in many cases. The one difference legally was that the indentured servant had been baptized and was therefore Christian, whereas a slave, you couldn't enslave a Christian according to English law. So any slave that became baptized then became an indentured servant. So it was a real tricky loophole in the law. Now I'm going to break for another. I haven't got to the crime and gang connection yet. I'm sorry, the crime, gang, and police connection yet. But I needed to lay this groundwork first about the Irish before we can really get into where the crime gangs came from in the U.S. and how police forces came out of and were a part of a development of the crime gangs. I'll get to that, so stick with me. I'll be right back. Folks, have you seen the silver and gold trading cards from Shire Silver? You have to check these out. They're specific weights of real silver or gold laminated inside trading cards, and they're a great way to show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. And now you can buy them using bitcoins or Federal Reserve notes. Folks, you really need to check this out. Go over to Shire Silver, watch the video on the main page, check out the list of merchants that accept silver and gold trading cards, and you can even learn how you can get paid to help spread the word about Shire Silver trading cards. Okay, thanks for sticking with me, and I'm going to try to wrap this up. Well, I probably won't be able to wrap this up in the next 20 minutes, but I'll give it a shot, and I might have to bleed this into a I'm sure I'll have to bleed this into a second podcast. But our topic here, in case you're coming in on the radio and you're just coming into this, is the connection between crime gangs and police forces, and how police forces are actually a product of the crime gangs, and crime gangs are actually a product of police forces. So if I don't get this wrapped up in this podcast, I'll definitely do a second podcast on it, and we'll try to get to a point of where you can understand where I'm coming at, where I'm coming from on this. Okay, so we have a lot of mostly the so-called Scotch-Irish or Ulster Scots coming into the United States into the colonies as indentured servants, which are virtual slaves. Now, in the mid-1600s, keep this in mind, in the mid-1600s, the indentured servant and slave population together, all of these people together in the colonies, only about 2% of them were African in origin. About 90% were Irish, Irish, Ulster Scot, Scotch-Irish, all these, if we just lump all those people together, about 90% were Irish, about 2% were African origin, and about 8% were other origins, which included some English prisoners and some Spanish prisoners that the English had captured, prisoners of war, and Germans that had become indentured for one reason or another. But mostly what we're talking about here is 2% African origin, 90% Irish origin, and 8% everything else. And that was in the mid-1600s. It started to shift later, but for about 100 years, it kept proportions very similar to that. And the reason why is because African slaves were a lot more expensive. Here's why. If you were going to buy an African slave, you think about all the process that had to go through to get a slave from Africa up into the English colonies. Well, most of the African slaves at that time were going into the Caribbean islands as slavery, in those areas. They were going into Brazil. They were going into Central America. Not Central America like Mexico, but mostly the islands and so forth, and the northern part of South America. And they were being used in the plantations and so forth down there. But in the English colonies in North America, it was a lot cheaper to buy, a pressed Scotch-Irish or, somebody under those circumstances. It was a lot cheaper. So for that reason, again, 90% of the indentured servants and slaves in the English colonies were of Irish origin. Now, when we talk about the Quakers in the 1600s, the Quakers were the most prominent group that were fighting slavery. And so their entire point was not, they didn't see a separation between who's a slave and who's an indentured servant. They saw all forced labor like that as slavery. So as the Quakers pointed out how unchristian this was and how immoral this was for people to own people, this really caused a problem with the Puritans. Think of it this way. You might have a person come to your house and try to share their religious beliefs with you, and you might accept that as this is interesting, this person's coming to my house to tell me about their religious belief. Or you might even be annoyed by it. You might be like, people ringing my bell telling me about their Jesus or whatever. So it might be annoying, or it might be okay with you, but it's a different thing altogether when you're doing something that deep inside you know is immoral, and then there's a whole segment of the population pointing out your immoral, the immoral act that you're doing. And that's the situation that the Puritans faced. The actual Puritans in New England were a small portion of the population. They were in charge. They were essentially the state. I've talked before about the difference between government and state, and so I should have called them the government, but they represented the state, the bigger idea of the state. But mostly the Puritans ran the governments in New England, and most of the people that they lorded down upon were either really poor and only Puritan because if they weren't Puritan, they'd be beaten or, you know, burned at the stake or whatever. So the true Puritans were the rulers, and most of the people who were being ruled over were either poor and Puritan by name only, or they were indentured servants. They were slaves. So this is how New England looked at the time in the 16 and early 1700s. And so when the Quakers show up and start pointing out the immorality of owning people, the poor who did not own slaves, did not have own indentured servants, they could relate to what the Quakers were showing there. They saw that this indentured servants, which is still slavery, they saw that it was immoral. And the indentured servants themselves saw that this was immoral. Well, the Puritans knew that too, but they lied to themselves, or else they just wanted to continue their immoral practice of slavery. So they would do things like, you know, burning a Quaker, beating the Quakers, branding the Quakers, whipping the Quakers, cutting their ears off, cutting their nose off, stripping them naked and parading them around town naked. They did these kind of things to the Quakers because they knew the Quakers wouldn't fight back. And so I'm bringing that up not just because I'm a Quaker, but this I'm setting the stage for what was going on in New England. Now, in the South, like in Virginia and North Carolina and so forth, you had a whole different setting. Slaves were treated much better in the South than they were in New England because Puritanism never really caught on in the South. And so the people in the South did not have the kind of moral superiority in their thinking that these Puritans had in the North. And so they looked at their bond servants, their indentured servants, and their slaves in a whole different light. You actually could, in the South, you actually could earn your freedom. There was one point in the mid-1600s, actually 1640. In 1640, that was the actual statistics where I said 2% of all the slaves in the colonies were African, 90% were Irish, and 8% were other. That was a snapshot of 1640, but it stayed pretty consistent until the early 1700s. But keeping in mind that of the African slaves in that 1640 snapshot, 100% of them had been baptized and were Christian and were therefore technically not slaves. So technically speaking, in 1640, there were no true slaves in the colonies. And back to the South again, you know, in Virginia and so forth, an indentured servant had a fairly good chance. If he really did a good job and really pleased the master, he had a fairly good chance of being released and being allowed to go out and own property and maybe even work for the same master at a wage and earn money. So these things went on in the South. And part of the reason why is because with the plantations the way they were at that time in the South, the plantation owners had a motivation to keep their slaves healthy and working, and whereas in the North, it was in many ways it was cheaper to just beat them down and keep them in subjugation. You know, so when we look at this and we say, well, okay, so why was there no Quakers in the South? Why did the Quakers never really make any inroads into Virginia, into North Carolina, into South Carolina? Why is that? Well, the reason why is because the Quakers were going where the evil was. The Quakers were confronting evil. So they had to go to Massachusetts. They had to go into the northern colonies because that's where the Puritans were and that's where the evil was. You see, there was a market for liberty. There was a market for liberty where the oppression was the worst. And the battle was in the North, so that's where the Quakers went. And it's very much like today. If you go to Keene, New Hampshire, back at Porkfest, Kai and I drove down from Lancaster, New Hampshire, which is way up in the northern tip, and we drove all the way down to southern New Hampshire to Keene so that we could get in there with Ian and those guys and use their radio equipment and get on the Freedom Fiends podcast that night. and Ian was kind enough to let us use their equipment there at LRN. Anyway, so as we were driving into Keene, you could almost feel, just looking around and getting the feel of the town, that there was oppression there that didn't exist up in Lancaster, New Hampshire. You could just feel the freedom up in Lancaster where they held Pork Fest. And you think about the difference between Keene, New Hampshire, where, you know, this so-called judge, this Burke, has made such a fuss, and there's been so much protesting and so much clash between the Free State people in New Hampshire and the authorities. That's not happening in Lancaster. And why is that? It's because there's a market for liberty in Keene, New Hampshire, that doesn't exist in Lancaster. The people in Lancaster are mostly free already. They don't need to have that kind of protest and so forth. And this is the thing about freedom. When I've talked about it before, it's kind of like air. If somebody cuts off your air, you suddenly realize how bad you need air. But if there's no restriction to your breathing, you go around all through your daily life and you don't think about breathing, you don't think about air. It's only the moment that you can't get air that air becomes really, really important to you. And this is the difference between Lancaster, New Hampshire, and Keene, New Hampshire. There's plenty of air in Lancaster. There's plenty of freedom at Porkfest. But you get into Keene, and you've got this little man in his little robe, and you've got these little soldiers marching around pretending that they're important. And that's where you get oppression, and that's where the market is for liberty. And in the 1600s, that's why the Quakers went to New England, and that's why there were no Quakers really interested in settling down into Georgia or North Carolina, because the level of oppression wasn't there. There was no market for freedom. Freedom was like air. So how is this related? How am I going to relate this to police and gangs? There were no gangs in 1600s, were there? There were no gangs. There were also no police. There were no police in 1600s. There were no gangs in 1700s. No real gangs. Some of the cities had kids, you know, that would put on different colors and have, like, pretend wars. But we're literally talking about children's play here. We're not talking about real gangs. Real gangs didn't start to develop in the United States, in the cities of the United States, really gangs like we know of them, until much later. I'm not going to be able to get to that in this podcast, so I will make a whole new podcast, starting with where I leave off on this one. But first, before I get to that, let's talk about the mid-1700s for a minute. Now, I talked about the 1600s and up into the 1700s, and how most of the slavery was Irish, or, you know, Ulster Scots, people from the English-Scotland border, and some true Irish that were slaves as well. A thing that was going on in Ireland after Cromwell, after the English, I should say it this way, after the English firmly got their claws on Ireland and set up their little puppet governments over there in Ireland and everything like that, it became a profitable thing. Let's say you were a businessman in Boston and you needed, you know, five indentured servants. Then you just send a message to another Englishman who happens to be, you know, essentially a landlord in Ireland, and you say, hey, I need five guys. And so he would just have his thugs go down and pick up, you know, they just go onto the street in Dublin and see, here's a healthy young man. He's about 18, 19 years old. Four or five thugs grab him, rough him up a little bit, charge him with some kind of trumped up charge, throw him into prison. The judge, who, you know, is part of the deal, he gets part of the bribe. The judge finds him guilty, and he's sentenced to, go to the New World as an indentured servant. And so you have prisoners coming out of Ireland, charged on, you know, bogus. So, yeah, sometimes there was real charges as well. You know, charge an Irishman for being drunk in public or something. How about that? That'd be a tough stretch, wouldn't it? A fighting in public. How about that one? Yeah, we can find some Irishman and trump up charges like that on him. And so off he goes, and he gets to the New World. Now, the problem was that, when you snatch an Irishman, again, we're in the middle 1700s here, where by the mid 1700s, the Ulster Scots weren't coming to the New World in the quantities that they had been earlier. And they'd pretty much cleaned out, the English had pretty much cleaned out those disenfranchised, marginalized Scots that were on the English-Scottish border. They had either absorbed them back into society, or they had marginalized them to the point of where they were not accepted at all in English society, so they were scooped up and sent to the New World. And most of those Ulster Scots and most of those people, those disenfranchised Scots from the borderlands, eventually ended up in Appalachia. Whereas the actual Irish that were being scooped up and sent over, as opposed to the Ulster Scots and Scotch-Irish and so forth, the actual Irish were coming into the cities, and by this time, including New York City and Boston and Philadelphia, and they were not leaving there and going off into Appalachia like the Ulster Scots had done. They were staying right there and forming their own little groups in those big cities. And they were forming their own Irish societies. Now, they were still a very small portion of the population in the mid to late 1700s, but they were growing. So now, in the mid, 1770, 1780, we had the War of Independence. And after the War of Independence, an unusual thing happened. In the northern states, the newly formed northern states, they outlawed slavery. But they didn't outlaw servitude. Now, technically, they didn't have very many slaves anyway, because it was cheaper to hire, it was cheaper to buy an Irishman than it was to buy an African. So there really weren't that many slaves in the North to begin with. So outlawing slavery in the North, it's kind of like outlawing snow in the Sahara or something like that. It's like, what did you really do? When you outlawed slavery in the North, what did you really do? Because there weren't any slaves anyway to speak of. But they didn't outlaw servitude. And that was the real problem in the North to begin with. So it appeared as though it was a Quaker victory, but it wasn't. It was a shallow victory. It was a false victory. And this is what happens because the Quakers had been attempting to use the powers of the state to get slavery outlawed. And so the Puritans cooperated, and they outlawed slavery in the northern states. And they said, see, Quakers, you have what you were asking for. Now go away and shut up. And the Quakers in the north, to a large extent, lost the thunder that they had had, but yet they had not really gained a victory. So it was a false victory for the Quakers, but it shut them up to a certain extent. That and the fact that by the mid to late 1700s, the Quakers had really started to be washed out away from their roots, and they really were starting to waver and lose their original, the moral high ground that they had stood on in the 1600s. By the late 1700s, there really wasn't a big difference between the Quakers and anybody else by that time. They had lost most of their uniqueness and the moral position that they had had. Now, part of the reason that the reason that the Puritans did outlaw slavery specifically was because they hated black people. They hated the Africans, and they didn't want them in New England. All right, now I've run out of time, and that's where I'm going to leave it. I'm not even going to label this as being about the police and the gangs. I'm going to have to label it differently. But the next episode of this is going to take this into how the gangs developed from the police and how the police developed from the gangs. And that'll be in the next episode of this, in this series. I'll try to get that out tomorrow if all goes well. So thank you once again for listening to BadQuaker.com. For more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go over to BadQuaker.com, and thank you very much for listening.